The following interview features Toronto artists Anik Jordan and Camille Turner. Camille Turner is with us in the studio. Anik Jordan is currently on the phone from Trinidad.
I'm Camille Turner. I'm an artist. I've been an artist for quite some time. I graduated from OCAD back in 1993. And my work takes many different forms. I don't necessarily consider myself a visual artist, although that's how I'm usually classified. I do a lot of performance. I do installation. It takes whatever form it takes, depending on what it is that I'm trying to do. The work I've been doing lately has been around history, specifically the history of slavery in Canada, because it's been something that's fascinated me, the way it's been so missing in the national narrative. And I really try to hold a mirror up to that silence, and I try to really think about Black memory in this place and what that means, and yeah, that's me.
All right, hi. So my name is Anik. I am a artist. More so, I guess, recently, an artist that recently kind of came out as an artist. So I have been, most of my work has been around community development within Scarborough and with a lot of the Black communities across Latin America and in the Caribbean. I currently am living in Trinidad. So I think a lot of people know my work in connection to performance and photography, where I stage different series of performances, and they're captured or documented as still photos, and then sometimes those still photos come back to life as performances again. I'm really interested in looking at methodologies of art creation that come out of a working class aesthetic, that think about the ways that we can understand multiple times existing at the same time. I'm really interested in the ways that we can subvert certain dominant histories and speak on things from a completely separate but yet not decontextualized angle. And I also work as a curator with using a lot of those same themes to influence the work that I do. And I think, yeah, that's it on me.
So I think, this really pertains to both of you. I've been thinking a lot lately about the ways that we think of history and how we kind of have often considered history to be something that lives in the past, that has kind of like an endpoint or like a stopping from the present or from present day and our future existence. And I think something that's very active in both of your work is creating this connection to history and making this line through to the present. And I'm just wondering if both of you could talk about your work and how, and if that is what you attempt to do and why.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because at the moment I'm engaged in graduate studies, doing a PhD, and it's really because of my engagement with these histories, with this past, but also with memory. And I think of memory as something that's not about the past. It reaches in every direction. It's not something that's sealed off and, you know, not accessible to us. It is us. It's living in us. I also work with people call it Afrofuturism, speculative fiction, But for me, it's a way of thinking of blackness as being central and time as being simultaneous, so that what is available to you is really so much more vast when you look at it through that lens. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much that's hidden with the Eurocentric point of view that's been handed to us. So I think of it as a technology to be able to see, to perceive, to enable what is there to speak.
I think so my connection to thinking about the past is just as rooted in my connection to thinking about the future, and I don't see them as separate things. Like a lot of my work is, and I think it's because I don't see them as separate things that I more so consider my work to be operating in the realm of surreal than as reliving an archive or as thinking of the future. And I think this is the realm, the surreal realm, the realm of simultaneity, I think that's the word, is the realm of the Afrofuturists. And so that we're thinking about how what happens or happened in the past continues to play out in the future in the ways that we live and walk with it in our own bodies, but in the intimate relationships that we have within the communities, within the land, within the geographies that we sort of move through. And so for me, it's become really important that I think about the way that I choose to produce work, that not just the concepts behind or the actual aesthetic behind the work that's produced, but the means that's produced as well, which is why I work within performance and in still images, because for me, the still images are something that is maintained and that can be become something tangible, can be something that lives within my past, and that will exist within my future as well. And at the same time, the images are something that are felt in a visceral way, something that transforms those who experience it as an embodied practice, and it transforms me as I experience it as a body. So for me, and Camille and I have had conversations about the ways that we enter this idea, and we've talked about how I enter it from a distancing perspective in order for me to be able to come in and out of it. And Camille, when we spoke about it as being an immersive practice where you have to sort of live the, either if it's the person or the geography that you're thinking through. And so for me, I just find it really interesting the different ways that we start to think about time and how it comes out in our work, but how it still is offering so many different possibilities within it.
I think something you both talked about, following up that last, those comments, is the idea of absence and erasure and how that plays into your work. So maybe, Anique, we'll start with you this time.
When I think some of my earlier work that's really nestled in the idea of hauntology, so the salt pieces, the pieces, even the work that I did for the AGO, the work around mass, the performance, and the still images, those are really... I had initially really started thinking a lot about them in connection to the haunting and into what's this question that I keep asking of what are the consequences of erasure. But it's towards the end of producing that work that I really started to think about the ways that I'm privileging these spaces of erasure and neglecting the spaces of a saturated memory or an inability to forget. And I think oftentimes those places exist in sites of loved ones, love, in spaces of mourning, inside the home, in places that are concentrated in the interior life, the life that is not accessible, that can't be commodified, that's not a capitalist product. And I'm more interested in that than I am interested in where is there an absence of like body or memory, only because I find that I started to get stuck into privileging those who have been active in the erasure, the acts of erasure and privileging spaces. Even thinking about the gallery as a site of these absences of erasure, the school, like all these different places, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm interested in, and I've always been interested, even as a when I was doing community work and doing work around community economic development and questions of innovation in the community level, I've always been interested in the question of what are we not looking at, what are we not missing, who is being privileged, and therefore what is missed. And so I think right now I've been so in debt ingrained into that question of what is missed that I'm not actually asking it the way it needs to be asked in order to really find possibilities and like and then be able to not just create these possibilities in art for, as an art form, but to live them and to theorize around them so that others can live them and understand them from different perspectives. So I think that's more so what I'm interested in now, these sites of like very potent memory.
Right. Camille?
Yeah, as we're speaking, I'm working on a piece. It's a walk of this area. It's called Black Grange. This area here has been my entry point into this history, and it's because I came into this area knowing that there had been a Black community, and then looking around and thinking, but what is here? What's here that's marking this? I didn't know very much about the Black community at the time, so I brought Afua Cooper onto my project. Afua was giving me stories that dated way back to 1793, to the town's founding, and that's when I realized that, wow, this history is really long. But I really was taken by a character who lived here, Peggy Pompadour, who was a woman who walked in this place before me. And, you know, Anik, you talk about haunting. That I feel like she really haunts me, because when I'm walking in this neighborhood, I always think about her. She's somebody who I feel I walk with, or she's walking with me. And it's a reminder that, as you say, there are lots of, I don't believe that, you know, once, especially when people are not acknowledged, I really think that their memory lives on, definitely alive and here and potent, you know. Potent for me and potent for the work that I'm doing. She's been a real inspiration. So the walk that I'm working on right now, the Black Grange, what I try to do is to think about it from the point of view of a time when all of these stories are marked. The archive is open and they're accessible, and it's used as a space of healing so that people understand what they're walking on. And so I open this space so that people, and invite people to come and walk with me. And then because I'm thinking of it through different temporalities, or thinking about time as being simultaneous, you know, I'm really reflecting on what's here right now. But I'm really thinking about, you know, what would happen if Peggy and her son Jupiter, who were up for sale in 1806, came here right now. What would they see on these streets, you know, when they're noticing that all the street names are named after slave owners? You know, there's Peter Street, there's Jarvis Street, there's McGill University, there's, you know, Bobby Point. All of these names are the names of slave owners, people that they knew, you know. What would they say if they're looking around and they're seeing the descendants of people who used to own them? So these things really make that, for me, it's very concrete, and I'm trying to bring that concreteness to everyone that's encountering these stories. And I used to think about visuality, But and I think that's important, but I really think that it's more, I'm really engaging with silence. And silence, to me, means that, you know, everything's here, it's just not being heard. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about unsilencing. Yeah.
Unsilencing.
Right. That really reminds me, I just recently, there's an exhibition at the Ryerson Image Center called Collaboration, Potential History of Photography, which I won't get into all the details, but it's a phenomenal show. It's a phenomenal pedagogical kind of methodology. And so anyways, I was really taken by the photography of Horace Pula, who's a Kiowa photographer from about the 1920s to the 1950s. And so he was photographing in Oklahoma predominantly, and his work is, you know, it's phenomenal, and it's also like pretty much like just after Edward Curtis had done his like West Coast coverage of every, like documenting every indigenous tribe he could, and I shouldn't say documenting, because I think a lot of it was also was, you know, performance. This Horace's work blew me away because there is an element, I think, within not necessarily photography, but I guess art in general, where there is an element that you cannot, it's kind of like the idea of unsilencing, like there is a relationship between Horace as a Kiowa photographer photographing other indigenous communities, where there is a, there's like a love, and there is like a centeredness that does not exist in a lot of other, you know, work, specifically when you look at like the canon of photo history in particular. But I think what both of you are kind of talking about is this thing that I find hard to put language around, I guess, in terms of, and like when you said that there's this silence or this unsilencing, do you feel like you're both trying to find ways of describing or uncovering this?
Yeah. I'm really glad you said love, because that's how I think of it. I think of what I do as an act of love and an act of caring, mm-hmm. you know? And I feel like I try to be a willing medium for what mm-hmm. what is and what needs to speak. Yeah, I feel like it's a huge responsibility, and I'm really grateful to be able to be here right now, and I take this responsibility really seriously, because there's a lot at stake.
I think that, well, since I've been here, there's, no one knows that I work as an artist, and most of my family doesn't really get that that can function as a real thing, and most people that I meet too. But so I haven't really spent a lot of time talking through the ideas that I'm working on. I've sort of been, which has been great, because it's allowed me to think not with my mind and make sense out of things, but sort of just follow the trail and then figure it out once I'm there, or see what it's trying to tell me. And a lot of that trail following is coming from a very spiritual place. I found out that a lot of members of my family are part of the Shelter Baptist Church, which is a syncretic religion between Christianity and Santeria or Ifa or Orisha, however different places call it different things, which is a traditional West African religion or way of life. And just today, actually, I was walking to the grocery store, and this man stopped me, and he's like, "Are you a spiritual person?" And I was just like, I don't know. And he's like, no, are you a spiritualist? So, like, he's asking me if I'm a Shelter Baptist, like a child of the Shelter Baptist Church. And I just said no, because I was like, I don't know where you're going with this. And then he said to me, he was like, you need to follow that spiritual direction. He's like, whatever reason I bumped into you and I had to tell you this is that you are on a journey and you're not listening to it. You need to follow that direction. And this literally happened like an hour and a half ago.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I sort of sense this like constantly coming up where, like, you know, even my... the work that I, the very first set of work that I did had this, not just this haunting feel to it, but it had this like spirit feel to it, like something was itself was haunting the image, and I find that a lot of the artwork that I'm producing is so tangible and so easily commercial or easy to go into a gallery space. And I'm kind of more so interested in the work that comes from a place of following and a place of intuition, and but not just my intuition, but also giving intuition back to the viewer and giving power back to the viewer as well to intuit on the image themselves or the experience themselves. So, I think it's just been a lot of following the signs for me and... really thinking about how these things that we're not allowed to talk about, like we're not allowed to talk about love as a real paradigm towards seeing things in the world. We're not allowed to talk about it in like school, and you know, so many places it's just dismissed or thought of as fluffy. But I'm really interested in this idea that like love, like spiritual realms, like the sacred, that cannot be held, but like is sort of commanding attention and commanding a response in a way.
Yeah, there's two threads, because we have done, as I mentioned, a number of interviews. So the concept of love has come up repeatedly, and particularly in the conversation with Cyrus Ware we had last week. But I also just wanted to touch base. We spoke to Jan Wade on the phone, another artist who originally from Hamilton, who's now in Vancouver, and her work around, you mentioned Santeria and spirituality, has been something that really informed her work. So part of this whole series is to also make some connections to people that haven't existed. So hopefully Liz and I can connect you with Jan. But maybe on that thread, because we back to you, Camille, because you Jan's an artist that you know.
We've never met.
But you know the work.
But yeah, yeah, I know
yeah,
the work.
Yeah. So I wonder if you and certainly the spiritual has been deep in her work for a long time, coming out of the Baptist and the BME Church in Hamilton. But can you talk a bit about the like following on what Anik just said about the place of the spiritual and maybe some of the challenges of bringing that out in the art world into the work?
Yeah, well, I just remember when I first found out about Peggy Pompadour, how I was just so taken with her and her presence. And but I kept thinking, and there's very few pieces of archival evidence that mentions Peggy. She exists because she resisted. I mean, we know she exists because she resisted. There's lots of people who we don't know, but I just know about her because of these little fragments in the archive. And I really wanted to find a way to... Yeah, I didn't know what to do with this. And I just remember meeting Jackie Alexander years ago. Jackie Alexander used to teach at U of T, and she is an extraordinary person. I just remember her lecturing one time, and I've never seen somebody just speak so quietly and yet hush an entire room. There was just... I don't know, you could hear people's hearts beating. That's how it was in this room. And she talked about this woman that she had encountered in two little paragraphs in a book. This woman named Thisbe, and how she decided to do this research project following Thisbe in the archive, and she could not find her in the archive, and she felt utterly defeated, and she came back. And she realized that, you know, I can't find her in the archive. And then something happened. She heard a voice say, Thisbe doesn't live in the archive, and I will help you. I just sat there at the edge of my seat, and I couldn't wait to just go to Jackie and say, Jackie, you gotta help me, Jackie. But then she said something that I realized, you know, like she needed to say. It's like, well, that was my journey. You need to find your own journey. And that was, it's like she gave me permission to really just follow my own journey, follow the breadcrumbs, just really let Peggy speak to me. I don't even know how to explain it exactly, but it is being in relationship with. Toni Morrison talks about her work as being a collaboration through time, across time. So yeah, I think it's like that. It's this collaboration across time. I feel like I'm always in communication with a time that's not necessarily this particular linear concept of time. Mm-hmm. That I exist and Peggy exists and other beings exist at the same time.
How did each of you, like maybe your answer is in relation to Jackie, but how did you develop a trust or a faith in moving towards this, moving in a direction towards acting out of love, acting out of things that are not necessarily factually tangible? You know what I mean? Like in a world where we're so committed to knowing things in a very real, physical kind of way, or being able to count numbers on, say, this is proven. How do you think you've, both of you have developed the trust that you're going in the direction that you want to be going in, and that it's, you know, in some ways a calling?
For me, I think, Camille's work the same, and of many different artists' work the same, that we are creating work within a tradition that has often and always had to create work within this way. Mm-hmm. Some of the slave narratives would have been written in this very factual way, because you would not have been believed if you diverted at all from the facts. And so writers like Toni Morrison, who picked up some of those slave narratives, have had to create the interior lives, the parts of the lives of the people who were missing, because they were not able to imagine in that written text, because it had to be something that could not be ever disputed as not being real or true. And so it's within that tradition of Toni Morrison, of Alice Walker, of so many brilliant writers and creators, that I think you are, it's almost, there's a type of responsibility, but there's also a type of need to, or like, sort of urge or calling maybe to create something that does not exist, because there's so many spaces where there's gaps that need to be filled. And the filling for me is really important, for not just for myself to feel as though there's a wholeness to who I am as a human that can be historicized and brought into the future, but also for young people, really, and for them to be able to know that they exist in many different forms and they're complex beings. So it comes from a trust that what I'm doing is important, a knowledge that other people have already paved this way for me to follow in that tradition, and then the response that I get from the artwork itself that continues to speak to me after it's produced and tell me that this is the direction, and like this is you're saying something that is important, that needs to be said, that needs to be spoken about in this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Toni Morrison who said that she tries to find the truth beyond the facts. You know, facts can exist without human intelligence, but truth can't. So it's stepping into the story as well, you know, not sitting back. It's stepping into it.
Mm-hmm. How do you look at the work that you both created? Feel like, in terms of like reflecting back on it, do you spend a lot of time with it? Do you feel like these are kind of like extensions, like they're kind of do they move you into the next direction? Do you feel like you have a relationship with the work after it's complete?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm always trying to deepen what I do and to find different ways to bring people into that experience. I mean, one of the pieces that I created, the Afronautic Research Lab, came out of my teaching, actually. And it came out of, you know, I was doing archival research and I decided to bring my students into the archive to give them the experience of understanding that, you know, the social history of Canada, this white settler narrative that they've been handed, you know, is a fiction, and to really to show them, you know, that there's a lot more than what they've been given. And so I brought them into the archive, and it was so interesting just seeing how they respond in a place where they're looking at this social history, they're seeing people being sold in the middle of, you know, other things. They're seeing, you know, things that just don't really jibe with everything that they know. And so just provoking this critical thinking was it was really exciting to see the wheels turning. And so I wanted to create a way for the public to experience this and to really think about an archive as a site of healing, a site of possibility, a site of opening into a new understanding and a responsibility. And so so that work came out of that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's not just, you know, that taking those ads and creating something with it. It's what can this whole idea of an archive be or do? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm using the information. I'm using, you know, the information that I'm gleaning from my own self and from other people, you know, but I'm also using, you know, creating experiences for people and creating context to understand the work and the, you know, understand or articulate, you know, knowledge that needs to be understood. But yeah, there's always different ways to do things, and I'm just always trying to find different ways to for this work to express itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I do have a relationship with the work after it's been produced, but oftentimes it's less so the actual, because a lot of the work does end up being something that's some form of an object. It's less so with the object itself, but more so with the process that I and many people who would have been working with me have gone through in order to create that work. So, for example, a recent piece that I did for the Art Gallery of York University's Migrating the Margins show, which is on Clara Ford, a black woman who existed in the early, she's thought to have been born in around Canada's Confederation, and was incarcerated, or was put on trial in 1895 for being accused of the murder of a wealthy young Torontonian. And Clara is somebody who has been with me through my entire master's program. I used to do a lot of digging in the archives just with like keywords to try to find black bodies in it. And oftentimes those keywords, like it sucks the types of words that you have to put in to try to find an auntie, you know, deep-rooted in the Toronto and Canadian histories. And so, I found her with just a short paragraph that was in the Toronto Star, and then she started to just pop up in so many different places in the Toronto dailies, and then there was one legal scholar who wrote a book on the case of her, on her case, and she was accused of murdering someone, right? She was never convicted, but she was this amazing character, and she continuously is with me, just knowing that that person existed, and that creating work with her and for her, paying homage to her as like an individual who resisted in so many subversive ways that we can't even like begin to really understand. She's an example of one of how the work lives with me, and then how that work becomes lives with the people that I get to tell it to or talk about it with. So, and particularly young people, like a lot of the work that I do is for people who are much older than me and people who are much younger than me, because for me it's a way of paying homage to the stories that they've given me, and for me to ensure that young, particularly black girls, don't grow up with the same types of experiences, the same types of I never saw myself reflected, and you know, those same very common sentiments that a lot of black people experience in North America, I'd say, and in many different places as well. So it lives on with me, lives on with the next projects that I go and pursue, but it also lives on with the people who experience it, and I trust that they hold that with them as well.
Just to follow on that, we interviewed Gloria Swain 2 weeks ago. She spoke very highly of you, not a surprise. But she was talking about her role in the Mass at 94 Chestnut work. And I wanted to mention her to kind of come back into your work as a collaborator, because, and again, this is my understanding of when you put that work together, both the photograph and the performance, it wasn't just about, oh, I need this many people in a photograph. You were very conscious of who the people were that would assume these roles in that work. Can you, and you talked a lot at the time about impossible histories, and so can you talk about creating that work, but also the decision to have Gloria play the role that she does front and center as sort of as the minister of this missing church?
That photo began the process of me thinking about saturated spaces of memory. And so what it is a photo of a congregation reenacted, but in a site of mourning. But it's a mourning that is that refuses to pretend as though there's spaces and there are reasons why black people should not be mourning. But at the same time, it's a mourning that is owned by them. They're not being imposed. This is not, they're choosing to remember, and they're choosing to hold that memory together. And so when I produced that work, it was really important that within the congregation that there are as many people as possible, many people who have leadership roles, who, you know, elders, there's their age range in that image is like, my eldest aunt is in there who's like pushing 80, and the youngest, one of my youngest people who I mentor, who is about 17 now. And so there's a huge range of ages, range of abilities, range of so many different things that it was really important for me to have, to feel as though this image could potentially, and not, I mean, you know, it never would, but could potentially represent a type of cross-section of a black community that existed then and therefore is felt within us now. And Gloria, I think, was one of those, working with Gloria was one of those decisions that came more so from a spiritual space, from a space of like intuitive work than it came from a intentional, I need to choose this one particular person. And because of who Gloria is, I mean, as a mother figure, as an auntie figure, as as somebody who offers so much caring energy towards the city in general, but Black people in the city more specific, it was really important that for me that she held down that position. And as a woman, it was important that she held down that position. And as a woman who had natural hair, it was really important that it was her that was there. And so when we started working on the formation of that piece, because it's one photograph, but it took 8 hours to produce it, and you know, months of like a year almost of working and thinking and reading to produce it. When we were working on capturing the image itself, I kept on reiterating to everyone what this image was about, and the fact that I wanted them to be holding within themselves this like really palpable memory that could not be penetrated elsewise, like by anyone else. And Gloria, she's such a leader, and so Gloria just held that down for the entire crew, who was really, I mean, doing an 8 hour shoot, you're exhausted by like the fifth hour, the second hour even, but Gloria held that down. And so to have her, to work with her, and just to work with that group of people as well, and to have them give so much of their time, you know, that's the reason why I think I work in the realm of performance. And even when that image moved from a still to becoming a performance itself, and it carried across the AGO and across the atrium floor, it felt as though time had stopped. It felt as though everyone was protecting each other, and I was protecting them, and they were in return protecting me, and something had shifted. Even for that moment, they were like gliding across the floor, like I felt nothing else but them. Something had shifted, and then immediately, as the performance ended, it returned back to its normal state. And like, I could feel that, they could feel that. It was such a dramatic shift. So, yeah, I mean, and those people, I wanted to have 30 members of Toronto's Black community who were activists, elders, leaders, artists, people who, and those roles are very, very, very open for me. I don't think of somebody as being an activist or an artist just because they, I don't know, have a show or do or go to a protest. Like, I mean, my mom was in there. She would never identify as either of those things. And so, you know, like, for me, that was it, right? Like, that's the whole reason I do this work, so that we can feel something and imagine something different.
I'm hearing what you're saying about having this specific experience that happened. Do you both feel like that's the main focal point of using performance in your work?
The perform, yeah, and even if it results in a static image, like the images unwanted are static images, mm-hmm. but like Anik says, it's, you know, the work doesn't begin there. It is the experience of creating the work, of thinking about it, of bringing it into being, and the people, you know, working with the people that are embodying it. You know, we're embodying this mm-hmm. together. It's, yeah, there's something really profound about it. And yeah, I always feel so grateful to be able to have that experience, to be able to share this. Yeah, and I was a part of Anik's performance at the AGO. I will never forget that. That was really, really special. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. Taking up space, and I think space is a really important thing. Taking up space. And the performance that I'm working on right now, the walk, that's one of the elements that I'm gonna have in the walk. And it's, you know, I was supposed to record it last week, but for some reason, the musician I'm working with, we just kind of didn't come together, and it didn't happen. Which is great, because then I get to keep thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm realizing what's needed. Mm-hmm. And it would have been very different if had I recorded it last week. So I'm realizing that, you know, the walk is a tour guide from the future who's, you know, bringing people through this space, but it's not just me. It needs a whole community, and that's that's the element that I'm working on right now. She didn't come alone, you know, and that's really important. And it is this sense of sharing that's, and I love how you work with different generations, Anique. That was really beautiful, being a part of that congregation in the space at the AGO, and everybody, you know, across generations. That was really, really something.
I wanted to just touch base on we're doing these recordings for Guelph, and just to acknowledge for folks listening that, well, everybody here in the room or on the phone is going to be developing work with us. So Anique and Liz working together towards a exhibition project that's a bit down the road, but Camille, we're working together on bringing the Afronauts to Guelph, to both the campus, to the archives, in collaboration with the Black Student Association, the Diversity Office, and then also with the into the BME Church space, with the Guelph Black Heritage Society. So it's nice to have everybody here together, because a lot of the ideas that obviously have been discussed and laid out are very much informing the work that will unfold in Guelph. So any thoughts to share, Anique, before we sign off? You're in Trinidad, just in case anybody didn't pick that up. You're working, do you want to tell us just a little bit about the work you're doing there? Because you're working, I think I saw an image you posted yesterday of working on building a 20-foot mermaid's tail. Do you want to explain that?
Oh, there's so much. Well, I am, I'm here working as an apprentice to a traditional art form that is literally dying, as the people who hold it, which are mainly men, if not only, are very, very old. Like, it's mainly old men that do this art form, which is called wire bending. And it is the epicenter of all king and queen mask costumes in the country, but in the region, and I would say globally, because most of the carnivals that are Trinidad-style carnivals have come out from the mask men and the wirebenders from Trinidad. So I'm learning it with a mentor who works as he's a freelance carnival artist, and so he teaches me basically. I mean, I meet up with him every single day, and we work on a new project. And so that 20-foot mermaid tail, because mass is all about reverse role play. It's all about the sacred and the profane. And fantastical things. It's all about politics. It's deeply rooted in a political history and histories of resistance, histories of being very satirical with like the social commentary of the country and of the region. And so you often see images that sort of fit into one of those categories. And then when it comes to king and queen costumes, those costumes tend to be costumes that either come from like a mythological figure or a legendary figure or a story that the mass camp is trying to tell. So this, I actually don't even know what the name of this or the theme of this mass band is that we're making that costume for, but it's basically a big, it's like a two shells that a mermaid is like coming out of. So yeah, I was working on the mermaid tail, like 6 feet. But what's important is the skills that I'm learning. And while I'm here, the big thing that I'm really taking in are the underlying themes that inform carnival, because those are the themes that I'm going to be working on moving forward with all of my art practice, and thinking about the ways that procession and mass groups, like mass bodies of people, what emotion of people moving together can do, and what stories can come from it, So, it's sort of similar to the work. I mean, I'm interested in deepening the types of work that I produce for the mass series, and then also thinking about the ways that I've worked with sculpture and with metals and materials that are found typically in working class communities, particularly in the Caribbean, and coming up with new ideas to work with the sculptural practice, the photography practice, and the performance practice all at once.
Fabulous. Any last thoughts, Liz?
No, minus the fact that I'm just always so grateful to be in discussion with you lovely people. This has been really wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. And look forward to seeing you back in this area, Anique.
Yeah.
With your giant mermaid's tail.